Welcome to the Traverse City National Writers Series. Over the course of the next hour, you will hear excerpts from the fifth event of the 2010 schedule, An Evening with Thomas Lynch. Mr. Lynch is an acclaimed poet and writer. His newest book, Apparition and Late Fictions, is a collection of short stories and a novella. The Traverse City National Writers Series brings some of the major figures of the literary world to northern Michigan. Founded in 2009 by Doug Stanton, the National Writers Series is dedicated to hosting great conversations with today's best authors, journalists, and storytellers. The moderator of tonight's program, Jerry Dennis, is at the podium preparing to introduce Thomas Lynch.
I first became aware of Thomas Lynch in 1988 with the publication of this anthology, Contemporary Michigan Poetry, which was edited by Mike Delp and Ed Interlaken and two other editors. And I was working my way through the book, and I came across a suite of poems by a writer in Milford, Michigan, who I had never heard of. The first one is titled "Like My Father, Waking Early," and it's a poem about his father, who is an undertaker by an undertaker, and that attracted my attention. And I thought, like many people since and before, have thought, interesting. This guy might have something to say. And the third poem is titled "For the Ex-Wife on the Occasion of Her Birthday," and I would like to read the first stanza. "Let me say outright that I bear you no unusual malice anymore, nor do I wish for you tumors or loose stools, blood in your urine, oozings from any orifice. The list is endless of those ills I do not pray befall you: night sweats, occasional itching, PMS, fits, starts, ticks, boils, bad vibes, vaginal odors, emotional upheavals, or hormonal disorders." And it goes on like that for two pages. "And though I do not have an ex-wife and do not wish to have one, I thought, this is a poet with a rare gift. Not only can he sling insults with uncommon grace and wit, but he has the quality, perhaps the rarest quality in any writer, of precise and daring judgment, of balance, of knowing exactly how far to go and not an inch further. I knew I had discovered a poet who did not hold back from the truth, who did not avert his eyes, and who knew the right words to say." And that is one of the crucial places where Tom Lynch's two lives intersect. For Thomas Lynch is not only prodigiously gifted as a poet, essayist, and story writer, he is an undertaker. And furthermore, he is but one of many Lynches who have practiced that unusual and necessary occupation. Upon the publication of the book that made him a literary star, The Undertaking, Life Stories from the Dismal Trade, the media seized upon the novelty of his day job and made it the hook they hung every review, interview, profile, and critique upon. I have always regretted that because, of course, media hooks are dangerously like meat hooks, and many writers have ended up hanging permanently from them. But Tom Lynch is a writer of bigger talents who deserves to be off the hook, who should be celebrated as a poet or writer or man of letters. I rankled every time I heard him introduced as mortician poet. And yet, in Tom's case, the label is more than a mere hook. For the quality is so evident in those early poems, the fearlessness, the clarity of thought and expression, the insights into the human predicament, and the gift of the right words at the right time, are also the gifts of a person who knows what to say to a grieving mother or husband or sister, and he knows what to say to all of us, not only about death, but about life lived more fully, more passionately, with greater humanity, about faith and doubt and the mysteries that bracket our brief lives. The world has responded with gratitude. Tom is a rock star in Ireland and England and on college campuses everywhere. And he is the George Clooney, Brad Pitt, and Sean Connery of morticians when he gives keynote addresses at funerary conferences. His poems, essays, and stories have appeared in many of the world's preeminent literary publications, including The Atlantic Monthly, The New Yorker, Harper's, Paris Review, Granta, The New York Times, and The Times of London. His books have been acclaimed by critics on both sides of the Atlantic and have been translated into seven languages. They have received the Great Lakes Book Award, the Heartland Prize for Nonfiction, the American Book Award, and one of them, The Undertaking, was a finalist for the National Book Award. His life and work have been the subject of two major documentaries, PBS Frontline's The Undertaking, which won an Emmy Award for the Best Arts and Culture Documentary of 2007, and Learning Gravity, a BBC documentary that has been broadcast internationally and was presented with the Michigan Prize by Michael Moore when it was featured last year in the Traverse City Film Festival. In Love with Life, While Trucking in Death, a celebrant of sex who is reluctant to use the F word, a writer of subtlety and power and inimitable and unpronounceable style, an exemplar of the healthy-mindedness championed by William James, who likes to fish and play poker beneath the stars, an expert on the gravest subject of all, and yet he is always laughing. Please welcome Thomas Lynch.
That was lovely.
Lovely.
Yeah. You drew me too far.
No.
That was vaguely obituarial, all the highlights you got.
I was worried about that.
That's definitely going in the file back home. So. Thanks so much for that. Thanks for outnumbering Jerry and me. It's a strange thing at a book event. So.
Have you had the experience of showing up when no one else did?
Right, in Dublin once. Back by popular demand, read the poster, which meant once too often in the same year. There were three people in the audience. The one that drove me, my minder for the day, and someone who was there by mistake. So, yeah. Doug is absolutely right. This is the book tour event that... that writers dream of, you know, to be kept in an asylum overnight and then fed great dinners and, you know, it's quite strange. And then to appear in an opera house singing for your supper. Easy duty.
Easy duty. I wonder, you are one of the busiest writers I know. You travel around the world to speak and to read your work. You consult on television projects. You teach. You fit a lot into your schedule, and you run the help run the family business. And yet, your production has been not only prolific but of uniformly high quality. What is your typical writing day like, if there is a typical one, and if there isn't, what's your ideal?
Mm-hmm. Well, my typical day is that I rise very early, and this is a habit I've been in for the longest time. The quiet time, I was a single parent for 7 years, and I noticed that the hours like between 5 and 7 were usually safe from any interruption, so they became the hours that I would work in. As far as the perfect day, I think I'm always trying to... Doug Stanton mentioned the dinner party conversation that evolves into a conversation about important matters in the language. For me, it's always a Sunday afternoon with my grandmothers. It was my father's habit to bring them home. They were widowed women, both Michigan women, but they were widowed for most of my young life and into my adulthood, and he would bring them home after Mass on Sunday and get them liquored up and always set them arguing about religion or sex or politics, whatever the priest hadn't covered. And I would say to him, "Why do you do this?" And he'd say, "Well, you keep your ears open. You'll learn more from those contentious women than you'll ever learn at school." And he was right, because they were opposites, Jerry. They were my mother's mother was from the Upper Peninsula, and she came down to Ann Arbor to go to school to study music. She was gifted with that, and her name was Marvel Grace O'Hara, and Marvel Grace was her maiden name. She met Pat O'Hara, who played in the marching band, and was smitten by the evidence of photographs by her ankles, apparently. That's the only thing that ever appears in the uncovered, and... I often wondered how these people made babies, you know, when you look at those 19th century photographs. But she was a rabid Republican, a union organizer. She taught music in the Detroit schools forever and did everything in the idolatrous style of the Irish Catholic. And I think I was her favorite. Whereas my father's mother was this quiet Methodist woman. She had Dutch relations, and she wore her hair in a bun, wore sensible shoes, print dresses, made wonderful stews and cookies and things, and never did anything outlandish or out of sorts. She was an Eisenhower Republican who, I think, voted for him into the 1980s. And the only scandalous thing she ever did was that she fell in love with an Irish Catholic in the 1920s, and it wasn't good news for her Methodist people, because she had to, as was the style of the day, convert to what she would ever after call the one true faith, Tom, appending this lilt that sounded like a question mark. Yeah. And she would explain the experience to me, saying, the priest splashed a little water on me, Tom, and said, Geraldine, you were born a Methodist and raised a Methodist. Thanks be to God, now you're Catholic.
Every time.
Every time. Some weeks after the eventual nuptials, she was out in the backyard grilling steaks for my grandfather on the first Friday in Lent when one of the... the conversion hadn't taken entirely. And one of the brother knights from the KFC leapt over the back fence to scold her for the smell of beef rising over a Catholic household in the holy season. And she nodded and smiled and listened to your man and then walked over to the garden hose and splashed water on the grill and said, you were born cows, raised cows. Thanks be to God, now you're fish. But it was my first, and she would say, ah, Tom, we're all the same but different, all God's children. And then there were all these lessons in their pronouncements, you know. But I thought that authority, the ability to actually change cows to fish by pronouncement, struck me as great magic and great medicine. And I thought, I want to do that. I want language that can reshape and remake and renew. And so whenever I don't have a day that I sit down that I'm not trying to replicate these two contentious widowed women arguing over sex or death or politics or religion, you know?
As a child, were you a storyteller? Did they listen to your pronouncements as well?
I don't know. I love the sort of the noise of the language. I didn't really care so much about the stories or the outcomes. I love the way syllables rubbed up against one another. And I love the sort of magical language that was part of my childhood. I mean, I had a nunnish upbringing, so I was taught to say prayers that rhymed, you know. Angel of God, my guardian dear, to whom God's love commits me here. And I didn't understand the sort of grim little logic of that. I could take it up with Oprah, but all I liked was the way that dear and here sort of had this acoustic kinship. And it was much the same next door where they were saying, you know, God is great, God is good, let us thank him for this food. You know, it was the sort of Protestant version of a grace before meals. Right. And this meter in rhyme, this memorable sounding language began to become, you know, I mean, everything I learned started with A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, now I lay me down to sleep. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, tiger, tiger, burning bright. Irish poets, learn your trade, sing. It's the same troche, troche, falling thus. Mm. Grief and meter order us. Mm. So it's the acoustic seduction of language was for me more important than the sort of, and then this happened, and then this happened, and this happened. When I was 13, I think I read To Kill a Mockingbird, published the year that they opened the bookstore here. Congratulations to both of them. Mm-hmm. This is the 50th anniversary of that story. So.
And you mentioned that you just purchased a new copy, have you?
Yes. Yeah. They're actually having a little event down at the State Theater in Ann Arbor to show the film and to talk about the book's impact on the culture over the half century since. So I went on. I couldn't find the original that I had, although it's someplace in my possession. And so I ordered the 50th anniversary edition. And to hold it, you know, this beautiful book with French flaps and the same sort of tree overarching the cover. It's brilliant, mm-hmm. and the sentence is leaping off the page. The movie is spectacular, but the book, it's the business. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really something.
Maybe this is a question for university literary critics. If it bores you, tell me. But in Still Life in Milford and in your forthcoming collection, Walking Papers, you have a remarkable series of poems featuring Argyle the Sin Eater.
Right.
Would you talk a little about the role that Irish folklore and Catholic tradition as well have always played in your work, and what role Ireland and the Irish play as well?
Well, ethnicity and religion, I think, in everyone's life plays a great... They inform identity in a way that is unlike any other, because you can't hide from it, even though you can become devoutly lapsed or a disbeliever. I often quote friends from Belfast who'd be asked about, are you Protestant or Catholic? And they'd say, well, we're atheists. And they'd say, yes, but are you Protestant or Catholic atheists? Because ethnicity imprints in ways that are hard to undo. And when I was contracted by my editors to write a book about Ireland, after Angela's Ashes did so well. They thought, well, Lynch can write an Irish book, and they paid me a fat advance to do just that. And then, but that I made the contract in the summer of 2001, and by September of 2001, the idea of tribe and race and sect and religious identity had taken on a very sharp double-edgedness. So the book became for me an examination of those identities. And it became much less the sort of jaunty travelogue the publishers wanted. But I thought, from my perspective, it was much more a learning experience to write. But Argyle is... there was a paragraph that appeared in an early history of funeral service that I read. It's called The History of American Funeral Directing. Probably you won't have read it, many of you. Dan Yonkoff has read it, and Peg has probably insisted that he read it again, and their daughter has lately read it. But there's this one paragraph about this functionary at funerals who was brought in mostly in Wales and Scotland and Ireland, and they'd lay the corpse out in front of him, and they would present him with a loaf of bread and a bowl of beer, and by consuming those things, he was taking unto himself the purgatory, the recompense that the corpse owed to whomever's in charge here. So it was a kind of secular priesthood because, he was taking evil in the form of bread and beer rather than presenting goodness in the form of bread and wine. Mm. And so they were often at odds with the reverend clergy of the day. And it occurred to me that the people had this huge ambivalence about them because they wanted them to be around when they needed them in bad times. Mm-hmm. They hated the fact that they had to pay them for the service. Mm-hmm. And it was not a whole lot unlike funeral directors or poets. Yes. Because we, we like poetry. We like to have it in the same, like good, clean drinking water, good roads, proper toilets and things like that. As long as we don't have to read any poems, We like him, and it's much the same with funeral directors, We like, my father used to say, better to know us and not need us than to need us and not know us. So you'd know he had time on his hands to think those things up.
From the Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan, you are listening to the fifth event of the 2010 National Writers Series on Interlochen Public Radio. This evening's guest is noted poet and writer Thomas Lynch. Mr. Lynch lives in Milford, Michigan, and directs the family funeral business.
Well, you have written powerfully and beautifully about, and this is not a pun, I know, about the gravest of subjects. And yet, that humor, like in your gift of a poem to your ex-wife, with that nice scalpel-like edge to it, which I love so much, Why humor? What makes you laugh, and why are you laughing so much in your work?
Well, you know the answer to this question because I see
I'm in your own work. Yeah.
It's because, as my grandmother used to say, that the ridiculous and the sublime belly up to the same bar, that the good laugh and the good cry, the wince and the grin require exactly the same muscles, you know, that... That the things that most distress us, if we just stand back, the same intake of air can come out in a good laugh, you know. And so I didn't invent that. I mean, whomever invented humanity invented this this appetite for the good laugh and the good cry. And I just love assembling circumstances in which they can appear at the same time, or when people don't know exactly what they ought to do. I've always said, you know, a very good wedding is the one at which people are weeping for no apparent reason, and a good funeral is the one at which people are laughing for no apparent reason, you know. But good events are ones, I think, that invite the whole emotional register, and good writing should do some of that, you know.
Is this a good time to read?
I'd be happy to read I'd love to read a bit from, well, and it would cover my publisher's interest in the event too, because they're peddling this new book of stories. There's five stories in this book. Four of them take place in Michigan, and probably I owe as much to you, Jerry, for making me feel like a Michigan resident, a Michigan citizen, because the way you've written with such reverence about our place, you know, and I think for current and future generations, they will learn how it is to why Michigan is different because of reading Jerry Dennis. And so for me, writing about rivers and lakes and you know, fishing and you know, abandoned rail easements and stuff like that, it comes from the same kind of reverence that you've brought to the notion of being on this peninsula. One story, the longest one, takes place in Ohio, or is situated in Ohio. It's about a lapsed Methodist clergyman, or as a Presbyterian pastor said to me, isn't that redundant? But they all get the dig in.
They do.
But the clergy have been such heroes of mine because, you know, usually between the corpse and the living people to whom the death matters, there's some brave soul who turns up in the middle of them to broker a peace between them, to say something like, behold, I show you a mystery. I think it takes real courage. I think it risks looking ridiculous in order to be sublime. And so writing about the clergy was something I wanted to do. I'm going to read three little sections from this story because it's the longest one in the book. And if, as publishers tell me, you buy the book but don't read it, which is okay with writers, you know, at least you know parts of it. So here, I think I'd like to introduce the character of Adrian Littlefield, this Methodist minister. This is the first couple paragraphs of the book. Of the story. The story is called Apparition, which, of course, is a ghostly appearance, or in Catholic theology, it always involves the appearance of the Blessed Mother. And she may appear in, you know, rutabagas or on the walls of a mall or something, but whenever she appears, it's an apparition. It was good riddance that put Adrian Littlefield on the lecture circuit. Before riddance, he'd self-published two pastel-covered self-help books with fashionably gerundive titles, Learning to Love in the Present Tense and Making the Best of Worst-Case Scenarios. They were widely ignored and only sold to his family and folks at the church where he was the assistant pastor in those early years of marriage and parenthood. He'd done a workbook on dividing family duties between spouses and written a couple of articles for the ministerial press, but otherwise was going nowhere and barely making ends meet until after Claire left him, he wrote Good Riddance, Divorcing for Keeps, and it changed his life. It held that some divorces, like some marriages, are made in heaven, and we ought to be thankful for them. The key to living in concert with God's will or the natural order or what the fates had in mind for you was to learn to accept the direction your love life was taking you, even when it meant the end of love. Divorce was neither the result of too much of one thing nor too little of another, too many heartbreaks or too few. It was like tsunamis and famines, hurricanes and genocides, God's way of culling humanity's herd of lovers for reasons that were unknowable to mortals, but part, nonetheless, of a larger plan. It took him 6 months to write it, a month to get an agent, and another month to get a contract and fat advance from a publisher in New York. It was an immediate hit. The first printing sold out in a week. The paperback rights went for $500,000. There was talk of a documentary for one of the cable networks. The invitations followed. He worked up a little 40-minute shtick for the keynotes and workshops. He could bend his presentation, peppered with tastefully suggestive humor, around the occupational curiosity of any professional association. He had an infomercial in post-production, one of those hour-long specials where he wore baggy clothes and did a little chalk talk with a really attractive and earnest-looking studio audience. He traveled 3 months out of every four from his home office in Findlay, Ohio, where he housed, behind his sprawling Queen Anne mansion on the corner of South Main and 2nd Streets in a carriage house he'd refurbished with money from his books and lectures, the Center for Postmarital Studies, an elaborate tax shelter, along with the foundation that raised funds to advance the work of the CPMS, which was primarily to pay its principal apostle himself to spread the word such as it was revealed to him. He'd kept pace with the rapidly expanding technologies, from blast fax to email and website, and some nights posting the latest news to his site or linking a recent interview so his followers could listen in. He felt not a little like Paul, writing epistles to the various churches. If, as that great circuit rider wrote, it is better to marry than to burn, was it not much better still to divorce than to smolder? Exes, Adrian's favorite slogan held, you can't live with him and you can't shoot him. A little good riddance goes a long way. So it goes on to detail his rise to fame and fortune. But because the story is a longish one, a novella, he has to review the occasions that brought him to this precipice. So he reviews the dissolution of his marriage. His wife runs off with a video film documentarian from the community college in Findlay. She runs off with him, his name is David Eason, to Cincinnati, ostensibly to film the last ferry boat crossing the Ohio in that town. But they end up in a hotel. And of course, Adrian has by this time had her followed because he assumes the worst is going to happen and he has to go to court, etc., etc. What really convinces him that the marriage is over is of pictures taken of the new lovebirds at Mount Adams, one of the hills overlooking the city and the Ohio Valley over the river. And this is where he had proposed marriage to his wife, Claire. And the fact that she would share this intimate space with a new lover was more of a betrayal than even the sex. So we pick up just as he's coming to these conclusions. That she would share their places with someone else seemed a more intimate betrayal than even sex. He called the attorney. He wept, giving their particulars, full names, birth dates, date of marriage. The papers would be filed in the morning. She was served as she left her class with David on Monday night. Adrian had left on Sunday afternoon and taken the children to visit his parents in Grand Rapids. He left a manila envelope on their bed with photos of her and David coming and going from their assorted rendezvous and a note that told her he had chapter and verse on her film project and would use them against her if she contested anything. It would be a slam dunk, he told her. She was to move out now. He underlined the word now. In the end, of course, she moved out not because of his threats, but because of himself and the dull life with him she no longer wanted and could no longer endure. She moved out because that's exactly what she wanted to do, and Claire could be counted on to do what she wanted. When Adrian and Damien and Sarah came home that Tuesday in the middle of June to the house they had all shared on the corner of South Corey Street and Lima Avenue, Claire and her things were unmistakably gone. She had moved out into an apartment on the other side of Findlay. She told the children she would always love them and would be coming back for them as soon as she got herself established. Everything is going to be really terrific, she told them. You're going to love New York. There's so much to see and do there. Not like, finally, Ohio. Wait and see. She'd come back for the last bits and pieces of her things. The white Toyota van was idling at the curb with the back doors open for Claire to pitch garbage bags full of her clothes and linens in. They kept nodding and smiling and weeping and hugging her, their little hands and faces holding and searching and wondering why this was all happening and why couldn't she stay with them and be their mother, and she would always be their mother no matter what, and someday she was sure they'd understand, and Adrian went into the house and vomited because he felt so helpless, so totally lost in the tears of things, so angry and heart-rent and utterly helpless, and their mother's voice trailing off as she left them on the porch, waving and sobbing, and jumped into the van with her lover and drove off into the future. Adrian stood looking out the screen door at the small figures of his children on the porch. All of this happening in slow motion now as the van disembarked and they raised their little hands and waved and waved and waved. No remembrance of these events was free of the guilt Adrian still felt for the damage done his son and daughter, his complicity in its infliction. Now what he could remember was the creak of the spring on the screen door as he pushed it open and held it open and said, "Come in now," and how the two of them turned, limp from the waving and weeping, and how Damien took his sister Sarah's hand and brought her back inside their suddenly and terribly broken home. This was the moment, these many years since, that Adrian Littlefield could never forgive himself for failing his darling son and precious daughter so profoundly, for doing them such unspeakable damage by failing to keep their mother home, the marriage together, the household intact, life as they had come to know it safe and warm and blessed with abundant love. He couldn't protect his children from this hurt. His wife, their mother, had just driven off with her new lover in a white van, leaving them all fixed and wriggling in the here and now without a clue as to what the future would hold. And as much as his heart hurt for his children's damage, standing at the kitchen counter buttering bread to make them grilled cheese sandwiches and pouring out 3 matching glasses of milk and cutting up a green apple into 6 little wedges and placing this meal before them and holding their tiny hands saying, "Let us pray," and hearing their little voices give out with the accustomed grace to it, "God is great, God is good," some corner of his broken, brooding heart quickened with the hope that his own life and times might just have gotten better, easier, simpler, saner somehow. "Good riddance," he did not say out loud while they ate their sandwiches wordlessly, but he said it nonetheless, "Good riddance indeed." So he is, of course, he becomes a sort of embarrassment to the local Methodists because, this is untidy for a clergyman to have a wife take off to Cincinnati with a filmmaker. So, and the other Christians in the community, the reverend clergy among them, sort of avoid him because they think that marital unrest is contagious. And so they pray for him, but they avoid him, except for one, a priest from St. Michael the Archangel's Parish in Findlay, Father Francis X. Con Cannon, who begins to come over bringing controlled substances and books of poetry, and he helps him with the laundry, and babysits sometimes, and tries to get Adrian out of the depression he seems to be in. Eventually, he decides that Adrian really has to get out of the house, and he convinces him that he has to go on a road trip with him. So he brings over, the priest brings over the fourth grade teacher from the parochial school and installs her as the babysitter. Her name is Mary DiDona, and kidnaps Adrian and takes him on a road trip up I-75 to Windsor, Ontario, for what he calls the Windsor Ballet. On the way there, the priest is getting high on very good marijuana, Adrian catches a contact high of some sort, and then he takes him to an Italian restaurant where he drinks too much wine. And then they go to this ballet that involves naked women walking on tops of bars around and around. And Adrian is taken with this. And on the way home, he passes out from the excesses of the evening, and the priest literally pours him into his bed. And the babysitter stays. And the priest leaves, pronouncing a benediction on the whole adventure. And the next morning, Adrian has to preach it Sunday morning, and he preaches every other Sunday. And for some reason, his preaching has taken a different turn. I'll pick it up there, and this will just take a minute. The Reverend Adrian Littlefield, recently quit by his adulterous wife, recently angry and lonely and bone-tired of the duties of single parenting, recently despairing, recently at wit's end over his prospects, recently drunk, recently stoned, recently a patron of a topless, bottomless bar in Windsor, only a matter of hours after having sex with his children's babysitter, whose first name he could remember but whose surname had escaped him, had stood in the sanctuary under the massive stained-glass likeness of Christ his Lord and before the faithful congregation of St. Mark's United Methodist on South Main Street in Findlay, and uncharacteristically lost for words, cleared his throat, opened his arms as Moses before the Red Sea, and raising his inexplicably grinning face heavenward, instead of commencing a sermon, sang out, off-key but enthusiastically, in evident praise and thanksgiving for all of his recent iniquities. When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. He stepped from behind the oaken pulpit, stationed himself in the front of the altar, and smiling widely, raised his voice again. And when broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be... And he was well into the next verse, though he wasn't entirely sure he knew it. And when the night is cloudy, there is still a light that... And might have even made some sense of all of it. But the Reverend Dr. Hingston, his senior pastor, sensing something in his associate's manner was terribly amiss, and worried that the 11 o'clock service was about to go seriously off track, rose from his seat behind the pulpit and led the people in polite applause. Then, wordlessly, by nod and glaring, signaled the ushers at the back of church to pass the plates for the offering, please. A couple of spiky-haired teens dressed in black and emblazoned with tattoos and seated with their perpetually embarrassed parents arose during Adrian's brief solo and, thrusting their fists into the air, took up the chorus. Let it be, let it be. Let it be, let it be. While one air keyboarded the piano chords and the other air guitared the heavy bass notes of the refrain, all the while nodding their spiky heads furiously in time. Marilyn Rubritis, the unmarried and, it was rumored, heavily medicated daughter of the long widow Geraldine Rubritis, stood in the middle of the pew she and her mother had occupied quietly for nearly half of a century, unknotted her long silver hair from the bun it had been in all of her life till it fell in quick, luxuriant waves over the red cashmere sweater she always wore to church, and began to sway with the singing rhythmically, her arms outreaching and her palms upturned, her bony shoulders and skinny hips achieving a kind of tidal sway, and the look on her face one of ecstasy, the way you'd imagine young hippie girls at Woodstock years before. Cleta Losi, the organist, never one to be caught off guard, had taken up the tune, which of course she knew, while the Reverend Hingston tried from his side of the sanctuary to eyeball her to quit, and the ushers moved with the gilded plates up the aisles, and everyone, reaching for their tithes and offerings, looked back and forth at one another, wondering what it was they had just suddenly witnessed. It had lasted only a couple of minutes, but it was sufficiently outside the pale of their erstwhile church experiences that they knew something unforeseen and unplanned had happened. "Did you see them?" whispered Adrian, still grinning like a simpleton. "The heavenly hosts," as Reverend Hingston led him to the vestry, while the bell choir, after a series of dagger looks from the senior pastor and accustomed to playing for time, took up their rendition of How Great Thou Art. After removing his stole and cincture and robe and following the Reverend Hingston's directive, Adrian collected his children from their Sunday school classes, loaded them into the family Honda, and drove them home. He sang all the way home. And because he could not keep from grinning, Damien and Sarah grinned back at him. For the first time in months, they all looked joyous. I tell you, Francis, it was the closest thing to inspiration I ever felt. the breath of God, as if I'd been suddenly loosed from the bonds of gravity and routine. Always before Francis, I'd be trying to say something that had touched their souls while they'd all be trying not to fall asleep. But this was different. I tell you, Francis, I felt alive, and they looked alive to me. For the first time, I looked out over that little sea of faces and saw them all as fellow pilgrims, not fellow United Methodist or fellow Christians or fellow sinners, just fellow humans in search of a way home. And I could see that what they didn't need from me was another sermon. It's as if I could see myself in them, hapless and lonely, holy and free. All of us somehow in it together, Francis, just trying to find our way home, wondering if we're going to make it. The priest nodded and smiled and sipped his tea while Adrian carried on. It was an apparition. They looked like innocents, Francis, angels, every one of them. I tell you, I could see their wings. I could see them readying to take their flight. Cora Perkins, Fat Bill Wapner, the grievous Fielding couple with their punk rock twins, they all just look so lovely to me, these people whose people I've been burying and marrying and baptizing. Poor Marilyn Rubritis, old Henry Richardson in his wingtips and banker suit, Art Geyer with his homely wife, the Morris sisters just turned 14 and 15, so proud of their new figures, the way boys are suddenly watching them now, Frida Chambers with her goiter and bug eyes, they all look like cherubim and seraphim and archangels, and all I wanted to tell them, Francis, was that everything is going to be all right. Everything would turn out fine. I could see it all, Francis. They'd all be just fine and flying again. A beatific vision, Father Francis said. Was that some dope or what? It wasn't the dope, Francis, Adrian said. I think it started after Mary. What's her name? The priest sat up in the wingback, set his mug on the table, and leaned into the Mary Didona. What about her? Well, she came to me in the night. There was this dream, and I just woke up, and she was there. A beatific vision, Father Concannon said, sitting back, pressing his head into the high back of the chair, smiling broadly. Adrian looked puzzled. A pastoral visit. The priest was evidently not surprised. God bless her. Now there's a woman with really priestly instincts.
From the Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan, you are listening to the fifth event of the 2010 National Writers Series on Interlochen Public Radio. This evening's guest is noted poet and writer Thomas Lynch. Mr. Lynch lives in Milford, Michigan, and directs the family funeral business.
I love when poets turn to prose.
Committing fiction, one reviewer called it.
Committing fiction. Yeah. Was it, to write it, was it like the weights had been lifted from your ankles and you began running and then took flight?
Well, there's some of that, Jerry. As you well know yourself, it's sentences are very fun and freeing events. I mean, you can go so many directions with them. But I do think, I mean, at least for me, poetry is still the thing without which nothing else happens. If I don't read poetry, occasionally have a go at writing it, then prose doesn't tune itself properly. I do think of poetry as like the tuning fork for the language, you know. So I think it's good exercise in the way that sit-ups are required for marathon runners, yeah, about which I know almost nothing. but I do think it's the same type of thing.
Well, Mary Oliver wrote something I've never forgotten when she was discussing the difference between poetry and prose. And as you know, she writes both. She writes beautiful. She's known, famous for her poetry, the reversal of most writers' situation. But she writes beautiful, evocative nature essays as well. And she said, prose is earned, poetry is given. Mm. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, well, poetry is work too. But yeah, I think we earn them both. I think poetry feels like wordplay. But I take Mary Oliver's meaning, and I think you're right to quote her. It's akin to something I heard late in the campaign, the last presidential campaign, when someone said Hillary Clinton was the best prose they were aware of, but Obama was poetry.
Ah.
That made sense to me when they said
that. Yes.
And, Although I could have done, as they say, either way, you know. It's great to have choices, you know.
Okay. Can we change gears a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. Maybe we should turn it open to...
how are we doing?
We probably should... We're getting tired of the sounds of our voices, I think.
Absolutely.
Maybe we should hear some others.
So, okay, great. Let's open it up to questions.
If there are no questions, Jerry and I have the 2.5-hour reading. Just waiting for the right audience. You qualify. So if there are questions, now would be the time to relieve us of the obligation to read at you some more. So
I think we can hear you. Now repeat the question.
We have a question over here.
Is that Margaret?
Here we go.
Hi.
Do you read out loud as you write?
The question is,
do you read out loud? And I think, I do like the acoustics of it. So I usually find the room with the best acoustics in the house and read out loud. Take a seat is what I say.
Even as you're writing a first draft, are you?
I know, I'll write away, but public reading, either to yourself or with people in front of you, has a way of knocking the bumps off of it, you know. If it doesn't read well, it won't read well for somebody else, so...
It's about this cat that you were so dedicated and ineffective in killing. Could you give us a précis of what all happened with that?
It's a longish story, and I've written a version of it down in a book of essays. I think that it appears in a book called Bodies in Motion and at Rest. The construction of the poem and the experience from which it came is in there. And just for the sake of time, it was a miserable cat, and I did hate it for a long time, and it's dead now, and good riddance to it. It wasn't the feline in general that I hated. It was that cat in particular, which I think is an important... point to make, because I did write, Jerry quoted that, I'd say enthusiastically unflattering poem about the mother of my children, and it wasn't women that I disliked, it was just that one woman, and I must say, only for a little while. I'm very fond of her now, in sort of a generic way. A feeling that I think she shares about me. But you can't write poems. I think those were still my drinking days when I wrote that poem. So while I don't disavow the poem, I don't say it out loud anymore. It was nice to hear a few lines of it, though.
Good.
It's still about the cat. How long did that cortisone shot work on that cat? Because that was the funniest part of the whole thing, was when you were going to put it
down. It was during Lent that year, so I make it March, you know, when they gave the cat the shot.
Right.
And the cortisone actually lasted. The cat would have lived a long time, except it was I had had this stone cut, 1978-1999.
Yes.
Thinking that we had an agreement with the veterinary surgeon. His name is Dr. Clark. If you have a cat you want to live, take it to Dr. Clark, is what I say. Milford Mitch, 48381. But, the cortisone was a lovely thing for the cat, but I'm a member of one of those programs that encourage you to fake it till you make it and let go, let God, you know. So I was quite prepared to just let that go for most of the year. But as the year approached its denouement, I kept thinking, 1978, 1999. So it was after Thanksgiving I had a small audience with my son, the cat's caretaker, and said, you know, I'm not the kind of guy to make a liar out of stones, you know. And it's not the money, because I get him at wholesale. I get him on the cheap, I should tell you that up front. Same with the boxes. I mark them up. Oh, well. So, but the idea of this cat living into another millennium when, you know, Mohandas Gandhi and Mother Teresa and Martin Luther King had only lived in one. I told the boy, if nothing else intervened, Mother Nature or whomever's in charge here, didn't do something, I would drop the stone on the cat and kill it. Now, I didn't do that. The boy actually took it into his own hands, and the cat came back from a visit to Dr. Clark's, wrapped up in a blanket in early December, dead. But you'd have to say for cortisone, the cortisone did a good job. It really did.
Hi, I have a question. You write in all different types of genres, and I'm wondering how is it that each kind of impulse for things that you're writing, are you aware of when you get the idea of what genre it's going to be in, or does it come to you as you're writing it? Does it change sometimes from poetry to nonfiction to prose? How does it?
I think I'm speaking for Jerry here when I say I just, you know, writers only get a couple good ideas, so they just keep reusing them over and over again. So my idea is to write the poem, then the essay, then the story, then hope there's a movie version of it later on based on the play that eventually will follow. But in general, poems tend to present themselves in big blasts of acoustics. You get a line, you know. For the longest time, our old dog long into its dotage yawns. Mm-hmm. You know, the way those vowels kept opening towards the eventual yawn at the end of that line? I knew that that was going to be a poem eventually. It took years to make the second line, which triggered the whole rest of the poem. But there was an acoustic impulse. To me, there's an acoustic impulse to poetry. Or a flash of an image. Or perhaps the Dairy Queen opens and they pay you to write a sonnet about it, you know. But essays are basically a reenactment of old conversations, old contentions between this and that. And it's usually not good and evil. It's usually between gratitude and begrudgery, you know, between the hateful word and just taking the garbage out and keeping your mouth shut. Essaying helps you sort that out. Whereas stories are a way of creating, you know, my wife said to me some few years ago, you've gotten to the age where you just make up. And I said, I could do that, you know. So I started writing stories about the same time.
We have a question over here in the corner.
How old were you when you started taking your writing really seriously?
Well, I started writing to publish in 1980. And so I was then 32. I had always read before that, and I was always, Doug was saying, the life-changing event of seeing Jim Harrison on Front Street in Traverse City and the idea that a great writer would appear in the flesh 20 feet away made writing seem a doable thing. Which you've done very well, I must say. You've really knocked it out of the park a couple times. You know? But I had exactly the same experience when I met a living poet. Because previously I'd only studied, you know, dead poets, and I thought, that's a big tuition to pay. I don't want to do that. But meeting a young man, a man just 5 years older than me that was writing poems, and actually seeing those poems appear in a book that came by U.S. Postal Service to me, I thought, this book is going to outlive the man who wrote it. Michael Heffernan is his name. And next year he'll publish, thanks to Wayne State University Press, a book of Detroit poems. And I encourage you all to read them. He's a wonderful poet, but like most of us, internationally unheard of and globally ignored.
Over here?
There's a young woman right there.
Both of your careers as a writer and as a funeral director seem somewhat solitary. Do you think you would have become a writer if you had been born to a family of circus actors or something a little more raucous? Do you think that the initial...
We had a fairly raucous household, actually.
All right. Yeah.
I think I would have written regardless, because readers end up writing. They, you know, it's just like going karaoke. After a while, you think, I could do that. Let me sing that song, you know. You know, you have a few drinks, go out to Rocky's on Tuesday night, and pretty soon you're writing sonnets. It just happens. You know? So, yeah, I would have.
Maybe we should close
Let
out
me
here.
Close, though, with a poem. This is, I have to say, when I was, I think it was about 50 when it occurred to me that I might be mortal, too. So I started marking every... The numbers are convincing on this, aren't they? You know? You'd think I would have thought of it earlier, but... So I started trying to mark every year with a sonnet to mark the passing of time, a 14-line poem about time's passage. But I don't know, the older we get, the less we seem to count, which accounts for this 15-line poem called, it was written some years ago now, Refusing at 52 to Write Sonnets. Before I read it to you or say it to you, I want to just say how word will travel around the writerly world about Traverse City and the idea of putting Traverse City on the map of the 21-city tour, you know, of cappuccino machines masking as bookstores. I mean, the idea that people can actually sit in a place like this with really fine people who could have been golfing is just a gift. This is a poem called Refusing at 52 to Write Sonnets. It came to him that he could nearly count how many June evenings he had left to him, in increments of 10, or say 11, thus 63, 74, 85. He couldn't see himself at 96, humanity's advances notwithstanding in health care, self-help, or new age regimens, what with his habits and family history. The end, he thought, is nearer than you think. The future, thus confined to its contingencies. The present moment opens like a gift. The blooming month, the green week, the gray morning, the hour's routine, the minute's passing glance, all seem like God sends now. And what to make of this? At the end, the word that comes to us is thanks. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
You have been listening to An Evening with Thomas Lynch during his recent appearance at the Traverse City National Writers Series. The next guest in this series is artist and fiction writer Audrey Neffenegger. For ticket information, please visit the series website at www.nationalwritersseries.org. This program was produced by Interlochen Public Radio. This is Aaron Stander.